You're listening to the Archaeology Podcast Network.
You're listening to The Archaeology Show. TAS goes behind the headlines to bring you the real stories about archaeology and the history around us. Welcome to the podcast.
Hello and welcome to The Archaeology Show, episode 286.
On today's show, we talk about three historical mysteries that have been quote-unquote solved by archaeology.
Let's dig a little deeper. Don't forget about the APN 10-year anniversary on the 24th.
I thought you were going to say something about digging into a tunic.
Well, it will tunic up nicely. Welcome to the Archaeology Show.
Hello.
It's another articles show.
Yes.
Because we're catching up.
We are catching up.
That's kind of what we do.
Yeah, well, there's been so much good news lately. So, you know, we had to have a couple.
Good news in the face of bad news.
We'll talk about that. Well, yeah, we're not happy about recent news, but there is some great archaeology news that Indeed. We are happy about. So,
Indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah, the theme of this episode is, I guess, famous mysteries. I don't know if they're famous, but mysteries being solved by archaeology.
Yeah. And I super love this because I love a good historical mystery. Like I'm one of those people that'll like deep dive something like hard, trying to figure out why or what or who or whatever. Mm-hmm. So when archaeology pops up and goes, hey, we've got the answer, like that's even more exciting, right?
Oh, yeah. Indeed.
Of course, it's never like 100%, right? As we're going to find with all three of these stories, I think, like archaeology might have found the answer.
Oh, it's always a might.
It's always a might.
Yeah, except for one part of this next story, which I really like.
Yeah.
So this next story is from a magazine from the popular version of The Mechanics, not the unpopular version, because nobody wants to read unpopular mechanics.
You lose your mind every time we have an article from Popular Mechanics, but I don't know what to tell you.
Why would you read unpopular mechanics?
They do some archaeology content and we like it. So
I think
what it is.
You know, Liz, with any magazine, there's got to be articles that just like didn't make it. And that really should be called unpopular mechanics. And they should have a website for that. Yeah. Anyway. Archaeologists identified the body of the famed horseman solving a 300-year-old mystery. Mm-hmm. And again, they're saying famed, but I don't know. Anyway.
Well, he was kind of famous in his time.
Once they figured out who he was, but they're calling the horseman famed. But the horseman, we'll get to that, has only been known for 2 years, really.
Right.
So, okay. So, apparently, the body of a famed Renaissance poet whose name I'm going to butcher. His name is in French, and I don't know how to pronounce his first name, but Joachim du Bellay.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I don't know how to pronounce that first part in French.
I don't know either because my brain immediately goes to Spanish because it's J-O-A, and that's a pretty common Spanish thing.
Yeah.
But it's not. So, yeah, right. We don't know how to pronounce it. But
yeah, I have no idea.
Yeah.
Anyway, he was lost to history. His body was.
Yes.
Since 1560, no one knew where he was buried. But in 1758, according to the article, archaeologists, which I put in quotes, because there were no archaeologists in 1758.
Right.
when looking under Notre Dame Cathedral in Paris, that Notre Dame, where they believed he was buried alongside his uncle, and found nothing.
Yeah. And then in 2022, an unmarked body nicknamed the Horseman because the bone structure showed that he had ridden horses from a young age.
Yeah.
Which I feel like that would be pretty common back in that time period. So, like, is it really a distinguishing feature to call him the Horseman?
I don't know. I mean, I think it would be because I don't think everybody could, like, necessarily afford a horse.
Oh, yeah. I guess that was probably a nobility type thing. You had to be in the higher classes to be riding horses a lot.
Yeah. Higher class. I don't know about nobility, but higher class.
Yeah,
for sure.
Higher class. Yeah. Anyway, so this body was found under the cathedral.
Right. Which we'll get to why it was under the cathedral here in a moment. But but experts now believe, we'll get to the punchline, that this is the guy.
Yeah. This horseman body is the missing poet body.
Right.
They are one and the same.
So back up a little bit. After the fire in 2019 that I'm assuming everybody's heard about.
Yeah.
The cathedral burst into flames.
Yep.
The French Institute of Preventive Archaeological Research, whose acronym does not include most of those letters, is INRAP.
This is the second time we've talked about this preventative archaeological thing, because we talked about it last weekend too.
Right.
Or last week, in last week's episode.
I think so.
Yeah. I guess that's what they call it there. So cool.
Well, I'm sure the French translation has different letters.
Yeah. Right?
But INRAP is the acronym in French, probably.
Yeah. I'm talking about using the word preventative. It's funny.
Oh, right. Oh, yeah.
Because we talked about how it was funny last week,
too.
Oh,
that other place. Yeah, totally. Yeah. Anyway, they were one of the firms in charge of restoration, and they made this announcement. Mm-hmm. Archaeologists discovered 100, exactly 100 apparently, unknown burials under Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. And apparently between the 14th and 18th centuries, now this is a big famous cathedral that people go to for, you know, tourism. But it's actually also just like, you know, a church. It's a cathedral.
Yeah.
Between the 14th and 18th centuries, thousands of people were actually buried in the necropolis associated with the church. And the cathedral is built largely on top of the cemetery.
Yeah.
This necropolis that was associated with this whole thing.
Well, it makes sense. I mean, you see those pictures of just like skulls lining the walls of an underground, like cavern looking thing. That's what this is. This is where people in that time period in this place were buried.
Right.
It was their burial practice. So, yeah.
Well, two of the 100 unknown burials were kind of set apart from the others in just in function and form, in being that they were in their own lead sarcophagi.
Fancy.
Well, the others were basically in wooden or the remains of wooden coffins.
Right.
Yeah. So these were different.
Yeah.
They were also in a more prominent location underneath the cathedral, where they're near the cathedral's main wings crossed, kind of crossed each other.
Right.
Yeah.
Because cathedrals are usually like cross-shaped, right? And so you've got the main long section and then like a cross piece.
Right.
Yeah, I guess. You know, because of church stuff. They're shaped like crosses.
Church things and
church,
stuff.
Church stuff.
Yeah. So anyway, it was a more prominent location than the others. And so they figured these guys were important. So it's really kind of cool. And I wish, you know, all archaeology was like this. But one of the sarcophagi was easy to identify because it was labeled.
Yeah. Hey, thanks for the label, guys. I know. Appreciate it.
Yeah. But that was priest Antoine de la Porte, who died in 1710 after 50 years of service at Notre Dame. Mm-hmm. So he worked there.
Yep.
And was buried at work, which is pretty much everybody's, you know, worst nightmare.
Well, that's a priest for you, though, right? He's probably
literally
honored
in
to
his
be
job.
Buried there.
Buried in his job.
But was he like a super special priest? Like, why did he get the super special sarcophagus, I wondered?
I mean, 50 years at the church.
Well, yeah, but
I'm wondering, was he just like cleaning it and fell in and they're just like, all right.
No. The other was not labeled and took 2 years to identify.
Right. That's what not labeling does to you.
Yes, it does.
It's like when you move and you got this box you just don't want to unpack. So Eric Shibuzi.
No, nope. Oh, not correct.
Wait. Eric Krubezi.
There you go. Good job.
Probably still pronouncing that wrong.
Maybe. I don't know. That looks about right.
We say things phonetically or how they're spelled. Not as, other
as English speakers phonetically. Yes.
Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, biological anthropologist and research director with NRAP said the person died of chronic tuberculosis and meningitis in the 16th century during his 30s. Mm-hmm. And they know that from an analysis of the remains, which is pretty cool. You can tell that.
Research suggested that the two bodies reoccupied a grave that had housed two people well known in their time.
Right. So they kind of like either pulled two people out and stuck these guys in, but they suggested that they weren't the original occupiers of those graves.
Okay. Yeah.
Which was interesting.
Yeah.
So, which was possibly why they were in such a prominent location. I don't know where the original two occupiers of those graves were or how they knew that. It just said research suggests.
Yeah. So then the one that has a label on it, how do they know for sure that the one that's in there is who it says it is?
They really dial into that either.
Yeah.
Like, was that the priest?
I guess we don't. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe the remains matched what we know about that priest and when he died.
Right.
So, I don't know. All right. Well, I guess you just kind of have to go with it. I
guess we'll have to ask Shibuzi, but we don't know who he is. So, anyway.
Yeah.
So, they started looking at people that could fit the profile of the other unknown one, assuming the label and the other guy was right.
Yeah.
And Dubele turned up.
Yeah.
Because they were looking at, again, the time period, the ailments, and this guy just totally fit the bill.
Yeah, and like who was supposed to be buried there too, because they do have historical records from this time period, so they have an idea of who should be there.
Right, it's a cathedral.
Yeah.
And a church before they built the cathedral, and they really did keep meticulous records
at
the church.
I mean, I'm sure over time some have been lost here and there, or there's things, and like inconsistencies that maybe made sense at the time, but doesn't make sense to us now. So like, I'm sure there's some struggles with, you know, going through those records, but.
So interesting thing about Dubele to match him up with the horsemen. Mm-hmm. Du Bailey was an accomplished horseman. He suffered from both conditions mentioned in, and they were mentioned in some of his poems. So the mm-hmm. conditions of the horseman.
That was tuberculosis and meningitis.
Yeah. Yeah. And interesting, if you read the article, you can hear some of the, they have excerpts of some of his poems where mm-hmm. he mentions this like fog of brain and some other stuff.
Yeah.
And just some of the conditions that somebody suffering from these two things would kind of talk about.
It's like the symptoms yeah. that he would have had, he's talking about in his poems, and those symptoms match the conditions that this body displayed.
In that time frame, they may not even have known what he had.
Yeah, exactly. They might not, I can't imagine they had those words, tuberculosis and meningitis, at that time.
They have known about tuberculosis, but didn't call it that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. They had other words for it. But
Anyway, and his family belonged to the royal court and were in the Pope's close entourage. So his father, him and his uncle apparently were supposed to have
been buried there together,
and that would have made sense.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, because if he died in his 30s, I'm guessing he died before his father. So if he had an uncle buried there already, then it would make sense that his family would be like, well, this is his closest family member who has passed away. So let's put him near... that family member. That makes sense.
Right. Christophe Besnier, I'm going to go ahead and pronounce it maybe Frenchish, another NRAP archaeologist, said the man buried likely grew up in Paris or Lyon due to the isotope analysis of teeth and bones. Mm-hmm. Now, this is the one thing. This is the one thing that says that maybe it's not him.
Yeah.
But it's only one thing of a lot of things, because when you do that isotopic analysis, he didn't actually grow up there. Du Bailey didn't.
Yeah, it's believed that Du Bailey was born in Anjou in Western France and later moved to Paris, dying around the age of 35.
Right.
But I want to know what later means.
Right.
Like, was he born there and then 5 years later he moved to Paris? Because then maybe his teeth would match, you know, like baby teeth, right? Like he must, if his baby teeth fell out and these are his adult teeth that picked up the Paris characteristics, then that would be fine. But I mean, these are smart people. I'm sure they thought about that too.
Yeah.
So. But I am curious when he moved to France or to Paris.
Yeah. And it's hard to say, too, because these people, if he's part of like a, you know, more of a prominent family, they've got money. I mean, sure, he may have been raised somewhere and grew up somewhere, but you got money. You don't just like live there your whole life. You travel.
Right. You travel around
frequently.
Yeah.
So is an isotopic analysis of your teeth really going to show where you grew up?
Yeah. It's not like it's
where your food came from.
It's not like it's stratigraphy, right? It's
right.
not like a layers of your history mm-hmm. of where you were. It's sort of this mishmash of what markers of what isotopes you find in the teeth.
Right.
So I feel like it probably is still a pretty good argument for Du Bailey, just given the other things, the diseases in the skeleton, the horsemanship, and where it's buried. Like, you mm-hmm. had to be special and important to be buried in this cathedral, right?
Yeah.
So, like, what other 30-year-old who rode horses a lot and also had these diseases would have the clout, the familial clout, to mm-hmm. be buried in this church? So even though it is a little bit weird that the isotopes don't match up, it still feels like a pretty good guess. So, but that's all archaeology ever is, right?
Right.
It's a guess and a hope and a maybe.
Yep. All right. Well, on the other side of the break, we're going to find out some other guesses and hopes and maybes about Alexander the Great's tunic.
Should we just call this episode Guess, Hope, Maybe?
Guesses, hopes, and maybes.
Yes.
Back in a minute. Welcome back to episode 286 of the Archaeology Show. And listen, before we get to the tunic, just because some mm-hmm. people fast forward to the end and don't listen to us all the way,
mm-hmm.
I do have to mention this is the last episode before our 10th anniversary live stream on our Discord.
I think it's the second to last episode because we release weekly. So there'll be one on.
Well, you'll hear this again.
Yeah. So
anyway, on the 24th of November, 2024, in case you're listening to this in real time.
Yeah.
That's right. We do release weekly.
We do.
And there's two more weeks.
As it turns out.
Shoot. Anyway. So 24th of November on our Discord, and I don't even know if we have a link to our Discord yet in our show notes, but we really should.
Yeah, we'll get that in there.
Yeah, we need to put that in there. Anyway, if you can find it on our Instagram, ArcPodNet, in our show, in our about us, mm-hmm. the Discord's in there.
Yep.
But if you go over there, there's a whole live thing literally all day long. I think Eastern time, we go on at 4 p.m.
Okay.
Eastern time in the United States.
Yep.
I believe that's when we go on. But it's a whole live thing. You'll see us live.
Mm-hmm.
we're basically, if literally nobody, none of you guys show up, then we're just going to do this.
Yeah, live, we're going to do a live show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
With our videos on and all that stuff. I'm hoping if it's nice, we're going to sit out in the back of my sister-in-law and brother-in-law's house here by the fire pit. That's kind of what I'm hoping, just from a,
we'll see. You know,
we'll see if the weather's good.
Yeah.
It is the middle of November. Otherwise, we'll just, you know, be inside and it'll be boring. Yeah, we'll just entertain your questions and talk to you and stuff like that. You won't be on the camera. You'll be able to ask questions, but anyway, it'll be really fun.
Yeah. Just mark your calendars for the 24th and follow our social media. You'll see more about it because there's a bunch of shows doing various things throughout that day.
Yes. All day long. It's going to be different things. So you can find your favorite show and join in. But if you really like this show, 4 o'clock Eastern. So 4 p.m. Eastern. Anyway, I got to give the movie reference for this episode, and that's going to be for this one because every time the movie reference, every time you're going to hate this. It is such a deep track.
Oh, God.
And it's nobody's even going to get it.
Oh, my God.
Literally, nobody is going to understand this reference but me. But every time I see the word tunic, and we see it often doing archaeological research for these, for these articles.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think of the movie A Knight's Tale.
What? Because they wear tunics?
No, because when he's like, when he's, and he's got to go to this dance, right? And he doesn't want to go to this dance, and they teach him how to dance.
Yeah.
And one of his like friends who happens to be able to sew, he has to do, he has to create, he has to make him something to wear, right?
Yeah.
And they find this like curtain or something like that, that is green and it matches her dress that the other woman's going to wear. And he's like, oh yeah, that'll tunic up nicely. He says those phrases.
You're such a weirdo.
And it just
Where
stuck.
Do you even come up? Like, how does that stay in your brain? I don't understand.
So every time I, like, when we put this in the notes and I was like, oh, that'll tunic up nicely.
Oh,
I've literally
God.
Said it every single time.
And there's your window into Chris's brain and also my life, because I have to live with that brain.
I just imagine somebody said to Alexander the Great when he's like, man, I really need something. And somebody in his entourage was like, yeah, that'll tunic up nicely.
Why are you like this? Why do you subject me to this?
So anyway, there's like,
but I do love that movie, the late great Heath Ledger. I mean, I'm down for it anytime.
If you haven't seen it, it's
fun.
It's a fun take. They use like modern music. None of it's real.
No,
I mean,
it's just
come
fun.
On. It's a fun movie.
It's old too.
Yeah,
because we old.
It's from like,
it's probably
90s?
20 years old.
I don't even know if it's from the 2000s.
I think it's the 2000s.
Maybe it is. Yeah. Anyway.
Okay. So, enough of that.
Yeah. So they. There's a few, actually, links to this article.
Yeah.
To this story.
Yes, this story definitely made the rounds, and I have an alert for textiles, a Google alert, which I've talked about before.
Yeah.
So I always hear about this stuff, but I got pinged like 6 times from 6 different news sources all about this. And I guess it's partly because there's a bit of a controversy about it, which we will get to shortly, but it's definitely been making the rounds lately.
Yeah.
So the article that we like the best is from Live Science. It feels like it does a really good job of like describing this tunic or potential tunic. We're going to have to put tunic in quotations right now and we'll get to why. But it does a really good job of explaining the science behind it and what the author of the paper is saying. And then also having at the end some of the like, not controversy so much, but just like the people who are like, slow down, take a breath. Do we actually know this? So I like seeing both sides of the story there. Okay, so what is this? This is a fragment of cloth that was found in a royal tomb in Greece, and it was found in the 70s, so it's been decades. And
hey, not everything from the 70s was just decades. You can't just describe it as decades.
Like almost a half century ago.
Come on.
Almost. And it might be the remains of a tunic once worn by Alexander the Great. And there's two mites in there. It might be a tunic. And that tunic, if it is a tunic, might have been worn by Alexander the Great. So there's a lot of mites.
There's a lot of maybes in there.
Yeah, let's get to it.
So the remains of the garment were found during an excavation of a cluster of royal tombs that were believed to have belonged to several members of Alexander the Great's family.
Yeah.
This is all very just like suspect.
Well, no, these tombs definitely are for members of Alexander the Great's family.
Sure.
And well, for high ranking Macedonian
people,
Greek people, right? So they definitely are that. And there's a lot of evidence that they are part of the family because of there's elaborate paintings on a lot of the tombs and stuff like that. So they do have pretty good evidence that these are members of the royal family. But who and which members are what has been in contention kind of for a long time. So, and these tombs are located in what is today the small town of Vergina,
probably known Greek.
V-E-R-G-I-N-A, Vergina, in northern Greece.
Yeah.
And in Alexander the Great's time, it was the city of Aegea, mm-hmm. which was the capital of Macedonia in the 4th century BCE. So that's the time frame we're talking here. These three tombs, they were excavated in the 70s. And they're just very creatively called Tomb 1, Tomb 2, and Tomb 3.
Yes. Welcome to archaeology.
Yeah. And this purple fragment was found in Tomb 2.
Okay. So the commonly accepted theory is that this tomb belonged to Alexander the Great's father, Philip II. He wasn't Philip the Great or Philip the Minor, just Philip II.
No, he wasn't great yet. No, he hadn't conquered all of Persia, basically. Yeah. So, yeah.
And this primarily because of the wealth of gold, silver, and bronze found within the tomb. Right. So, and that was still in there when they excavated?
Yeah.
That's what it said in the thing?
Wow. Yeah, they found all that. It hadn't been looted, I guess. So they have all that. There's this beautiful, like, gold. It looks like leaves made out of gold and into like a wreath, basically, that you would have worn on your head, like a Greek style, like wreath, right? But it's fully made out of gold. It's beautiful. So they found all that kind of stuff in these tombs.
Nice.
And that purple textile, of course, was one of the things that they found in there.
Sure.
Yeah. The textile itself is made of two layers of cotton that have been dyed Tyrian purple. And we've talked about Tyrian purple before. It's basically this color that's made by squeezing stuff out of the glands of sea snails.
Milking sea snails.
Yeah. Super gross, but it creates this really beautiful purple that is super expensive, hard to acquire, and only for really, really royal and fancy people, right?
I feel like I'll have really achieved my wealth and success when I can hire someone to milk sea snails.
You probably could.
That's like,
I think there's probably people still doing it today.
But it's a level of rich that you just can't comprehend.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then between these two layers of purple cotton, there is this white mineral called huntite, which I thought was weird to have a white mineral, but I guess it's kind of a powdery type thing. I don't really know. It might have just have degraded away over time, and it was just another layer of cloth in between that had that mineral on it. I'm not really sure. They didn't do a super good job of describing that.
Maybe it was their version of mithril. It's just like worn away.
Well, I thought maybe it was like for insulation or something, but it's a mineral. So I don't know what a mineral is going to do for insulation.
I mean, given where the tomb is and something like that, I wonder if, is there a chance that it's maybe flooded before, or is that mineral found anywhere else in the tomb?
It's just between these two pieces of fabric. Okay, so it does seem intentional.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's white. Like it makes a bright white color. Like you can use it to dye things white. So like it might've just been part of, cause it's white and purple, this
creation
this textile.
Process.
Yeah. It could just be from that. So, so anyway, well, we do have a new paper about all of this. So this is published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Field Archaeology, and the author is Antonis Bartsiokas. And he is re-examining basically all the evidence around this textile. He did not touch it by hand. He just is re-examining it.
Yeah. So the cotton was not grown in Greece during Alexander's time. So it had to have been imported from Persia, one of the areas conquered by Alexander the Great.
Yeah. Which makes sense. That. Yeah.
Yep. Purple is the color reserved for kings of Persia, which purple is reserved for the color of royalty pretty much everywhere for all time because of how it was extracted. It was really hard.
Yeah.
So that's pretty much common anytime you see purple anywhere.
Yeah. But like specifically, cotton that is purple would have only been for Persian kings, because cotton wasn't found outside of Persia until it was exported out. So that's part of this argument.
So Philip II would not have been allowed to wear that color.
Yeah. Because he's not a king of Persia. He was a king, but not a king of Persia. So he wouldn't have been allowed. According, this is the argument being made in this new paper, that he wouldn't have been allowed to wear the purple. So
And Alexander and the rulers that came after him could wear it since they were the new kings of Persia.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the argument.
Yeah. So he basically stole it and said, I'm getting buried with this.
Yeah. He conquered. But I mean, it does make a compelling argument, though, right? That like Philip II wouldn't have had a purple tunic because the Persians would never have exported a purple tunic to him because he wasn't their king. I don't know if that really takes into account like humans and how humans behave, but that's the argument. We'll get to that. Okay. So there's another reason that doesn't relate to this textile that Bartsiokas says that this tomb too could not have been Philip II. This is because the skeletal remains that are in this tomb do not show evidence of an eye injury that we know for sure that Philip had.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it sounds like the skeletal remains in there definitely are not Philip II. So,
if he had an eye injury, and
it should be obvious, right?
And that's visible on the skeletal remains, like a bone visible injury.
Yes.
That's pretty conclusive.
Yeah, they didn't go too much into detail on that. And I'm like, well, would the eye injury have actually made a mark on the bones?
Yeah.
Maybe the eye injury is there and we just can't see it in the bones.
I mean, if he got hit with something like a blunt object,
yeah,
you would see that.
You would
see a healed injury.
Yeah. Yes, yeah. You would.
Well, unless it killed him.
Right. But if it was an injury in a different way that didn't leave a mark on the bones, you wouldn't see it.
Well, if he just got like poked in the eye and he lost his eye,
yeah,
you might not see that.
Exactly.
Right.
Yeah.
So what was the eye injury?
Yeah, they didn't go into great
detail. Well, if they're just saying they didn't see evidence of the eye injury, they must think it's an injury that would have had a mark on the bone.
They do, yes.
That seems like it's...
Yeah, that's what they're saying.
Yeah, it's implied.
Okay. So moving from there, the author of the paper, he's basically arguing that this tomb, because of all those reasons we just said, does not belong to Philip II. And instead, it belongs to Alexander the Great's older half-brother, Arhidius.
Arhidius?
That name
is hideous.
Arhidaeus?
Arhidaeus.
Arhidaeus.
Arhidaeus, yeah.
And that's because he succeeded him in 323 BCE when Alexander the Great died. So, yeah, he's a king, right? He's
sure.
A king of Persia. So he gets to have the purple. There's no eye injury. And... yeah, so maybe it was him.
So he was killed in 317 BCE, and the empire pretty much fell apart after that.
Yeah.
So Bartsiokas also argues that the purple tunic first belonged to Alexander, and then it was passed to Arhidaeus after he died.
Yeah.
I mean, this purple tunic, though, it's just a piece of clothing. Do they really care about it that much?
Well, they're putting so much stock in the fact that Persians wouldn't allow anybody other than their king to wear purple.
Right.
Like, that's what the whole argument is built on.
But these people were like uber rich. And I understand a purple cotton tunic would have been, you know, something reserved for Persian kings. But wouldn't he have had like 20 of them?
Yeah. Right.
I mean.
Well, okay. So that actually gets to the next thing, which is, so that's a good segue. You didn't even know you were doing.
Yeah, I read the notes.
No, I know you did, but you didn't know which one was coming up next. So there's the other reasoning that this tunic first belonged to Alexander and then was passed to his older brother when he died is because there's artwork on the wall of the tomb showing Alexander the Great wearing a tunic that is very similar to the textile that was found.
Which it goes to my point. He probably had dozens of these things.
Yes. And one more thing, there is a ancient description from an ancient source that describes the sacred Persian Mezalikon Serapis, which belonged to Pharaoh and King Alexander the Great.
Yeah.
This is from an ancient source. So again, its description is in historical texts. So, like, there's a lot of reasons why Alexander the Great would have worn a purple tunic.
Yeah.
But now...
he was fashionable.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there's a really solid maybe here.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, one scholar, Heraclea Brekalaki, says that there's no evidence to support the idea that this fabric, this piece of textile, is actually a tunic. And according to them... the textile, according to the excavators, looked more like a piece of scarf that would have wrapped the bones of the deceased.
Ah.
So first question here is this actually a tunic?
Right.
Or is it just a piece of fabric?
Right.
Right. It was purple, though. So, like, are you wrapping deceased in this really, really hard to acquire fabric? I don't know.
You'd wrap a king in it.
I guess you would wrap a king in it.
Yeah.
So maybe. So it's a good argument.
You'd wrap a king in it.
Yeah. And I think they just have a tiny fabric, so they don't have the whole thing. They don't have any seams showing that it was sewn together like a tunic or whatever. So, yeah.
And then another scholar, Athanasia Kirikou, says the assumptions being drawn are ignoring the complete archaeological background of the site, and also that Bartsiokas did not conduct any tests on the material and actually has not even seen them. So he's just kind of going off the notes and what was done. So...
and the past test, the test from the past.
Well, test from the past.
Honestly...
test from the 70s?
I think it was later than that, but
okay, but still.
So here's my thing. I put that quote in there because I felt like it was important to say why other Greek scholars are disagreeing. But doesn't that disagreement feel a little bit like somebody who is pushing back because they don't want to change their assumptions?
I mean, sure.
That's how that argument came across to me a little bit. Like, they just didn't want to... they weren't interested in having this re-examination of this piece. They had this assumption that they were already holding for the last 20, 30 years or whatever, and they weren't interested in changing that.
Here's where I'm at. Do we think this is a piece of purple cotton fabric from the 300s BCE? Alexander the Great's time frame in Persia?
Yes, we do. Yeah, we definitely know that for sure. 100%.
Great. Full stop, period. Who cares about the rest?
But it it's important who it belonged to.
Who cared if even... okay, it belonged to probably a Persian king... right?
Yeah, it belonged to a royal family member.
Right.
In the Alexander the Great family.
Who cares if Alexander the Great actually wore it is kind of where I'm at. Like, it's just like we get hung up on that.
Yeah.
The history is still super cool. It was probably near him. It was part of this, like, this whole Alexander the Great, you know, mythos sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. All of that's just, true.
All of that's super cool. Like, it would be really neat if you could say that, you know, whatever this painting was, somebody probably saw that scene, or it came out of their head, right? Just like magically out of their head, they like, I want to paint this thing. Or they actually saw this scene and said, I want to paint that. Nobody was probably standing there saying, get on with the painting, we're standing here.
Right.
That's not how that worked. It wasn't a photograph. But if he was actually wearing the thing that they found, it would be highly unlikely, because like I said, he probably had 100 of them. Yeah. Right. So it's just, who cares?
Yeah.
Get on with it. You nailed down where it was and where it came from, and it probably belonged to that family. Move on with your life and study something else.
The thing that I get a little bit hung up on is this hard stop. Persian people would not have exported purple cotton to anybody.
They're like real stingy with it.
because it's only for their kings. I'm just like, people will do anything for money. And you cannot tell me that there's not a cotton merchant or a cotton dyer in Persia at this time frame that got offered like a boatload of money to make a tunic for some dude. I just feel like they would cut your hand off for stealing.
I could see them
money
really,
talks.
Well,
money
I understand talks. That. And there's an underground market, and you'll, if you got to feed your family, you'll get it out. But if you get found out not selling to the Persian royal family and you're selling to somebody else, you're probably going to die.
If they had full control over the production process of this purple and it didn't go outside of like the royal cloth makers or whatever, then sure. Yeah. They're going to stay. That's possible.
I mean, if that was a royal thing.
But like, people be people. That's all I'm saying. I get the opportunity to make a bunch of money, to raise your status, whatever. And it just requires breaking this one rule. Like, I totally see people doing that. Anyway, I don't know. I think it's so interesting. And I love this argument, this back and forth argument about whose tomb it is, even though in the end, I guess it doesn't really matter, but it is just still fun to speculate. And I also like to see a person who is challenging status quo, because just because it's a long-held assumption doesn't mean that it's true, especially in archaeology where you're always drawing assumptions. And it's just changing from one assumption to another assumption. I get that, but it's just fun to speculate and just make sure that you're taking into account all the evidence when you are speculating. So,
all right.
I don't know. I kind of love it.
Well, another long-held assumption is that one of the early colonies in America stayed in the Outer Banks, but maybe they just thought that show was stupid and they went inland. Back on the other side.
No, we're not talking about that show.
Welcome back to episode 286.
So many episodes.
Of the Archaeology Show. All right.
Yeah.
Don't forget November 24th.
Yeah, definitely. Discord. Be there or be square.
Oh my God.
What does being square mean exactly?
Well,
like boring?
Yeah.
Like you're a square?
Yeah, welcome to the 80s.
I was a child in the 80s, okay?
Yeah, but you don't know what square meant.
Anyway.
Yeah, okay.
So we have another historical mystery.
Yes, and the cool kind of thing about this is just almost on a lark in the last like few days before we left the Outer Banks, back when we were RVers a couple of months ago.
Yeah, back before we lived in my sister's basement.
This national park was just like on our route.
Yeah.
And I thought we were going to stop for just like maybe 10 minutes or so.
I never had that thought.
Check out the visitor center.
I never believed that.
Right. We stopped at the Roanoke Fort. What was it actually called?
Fort Raleigh.
Fort Raleigh. That's right.
Fort Raleigh National Historic Site, I think.
Right. Fort Raleigh National Historic Site. And we went in. They actually have a pretty decent visitor center with some artifacts that have been pulled up from there. And
really? Some great artifacts too, like they found some really good stuff when they've done excavations in this area.
And it just so happened they had a ranger-led discussion and trip around the park planned, and Rachel's like, oh yeah, let's do that. And I want to get back on the road, because they're like a 7-hour drive that day.
It was not that bad, and we were going to a park where we had a good spot ready to go. It was fine. I'm a sucker for a ranger-led talk. I have to stay for it. I know. I just do.
And we get out there and it turns out it's just the two of us. And I'm like, "Oh, hey, Ranger Dave, how long is this?" And he's like, "Oh, it's no more than like an hour, hour and a half." I'm like,
"No, he said 45 minutes. He said 45 minutes. And you
he
know
was
what?
Super cool.
You're Mr. Chatty, and you have to get in there and start asking questions. So you're the one who makes it take longer.
I mean, if we're doing it, we're doing it."
Anyway, we can't really recommend a visit to the Fort Raleigh Historical Site enough if you're interested in that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it was kind of
you
cool.
Like a good tour and you're into this mystery. And I've said this before, but I'm from North Carolina. So like the Roanoke colony that disappeared in the 1500s was just probably one of the very first things that got me interested in archaeology, even though I didn't even know it was archaeology yet. Just interested in history and the mystery around it. And like, you know, if you can solve it, which you can't, and we'll find out that you still really can't solve it. But
for all of you, this is for people in the United States, because our like Australian listeners,
oh,
our
yeah,
UK
they're like,
listeners,
like,
they're
Roanoke,
like,
what the?
Roanoke, who now?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe the UK listeners yeah, are we, like, yeah, we sent people over there and you sent them back. But anyway.
Yeah, we'll go through the real, right. The quick history of it.
But for my West Coast homies in the United States, mm-hmm. Yeah, I know we didn't learn about this. And if
no,
we did, it was
did
like
not.
A footnote in one of our books. Because up in Washington, I learned about totem poles and, you know, people
yeah.
who settled Washington and
yeah.
things like that, which was still super cool. But when we learned about like early U.S. history, I mean, this wasn't as big a deal.
I know. Well, I'll tell you what, on my side of the country, you know what wasn't a big deal? Lewis and Clark. It was a little blip. It was a footnote.
Yeah.
For you?
Yeah.
Probably like a whole chapter, right?
I mean, it was a big deal because otherwise Washington and Oregon wouldn't exist.
Right, exactly. It's crazy how the regional differences in teaching are when you're younger. When you
sure.
get older, obviously, you
sure.
dial into the yeah. details. But anyway.
Yeah, I mean, we learned about Jamestown and
yeah,
the Pilgrims
yeah.
and, you know, yeah. Plymouth Rock and all that stuff. But like Roanoke was nothing.
Yeah.
So.
Well, it was big in mine. And it might have just been my brain making it bigger, too. Because I was
sure.
fascinated and I'm still fascinated.
Well,
okay.
You've got an entire county and areas named after a baby. So, you know, let's
yeah,
get into
we
it.
Do. Okay, let's do it. All right. So in 1585, English settlers reached the New World and established a colony on the island of Roanoke in what is now part of North Carolina.
In the Outer Banks.
In the Outer Banks, but like not.
Kind of like the Middle Banks.
Yeah, it's like in between the mainland and the Outer Banks, basically. There's an yeah. island called Roanoke and that is where they were establishing this colony, right? And then a couple of years later, it mysteriously vanished. There's your bird's eye view. That's what happened.
Yeah. The story actually starts with Sir Walter Raleigh, incidentally, another city in North
yeah,
Carolina.
Yeah, well, Raleigh is the capital of North Carolina. Yeah.
Yeah. So, but not everybody knows that.
You not say everybody. Like, I know. I
like,
know.
Oh, yeah. Raleigh.
I grew anyway. Up here. I don't know what to tell you.
He was given a charter by Queen Elizabeth. Queen Elizabeth is part of a little island in the Atlantic called England. Anyway. to build a colony in the New World, right? And because, to be honest, they were at odds with Spain at the time.
Yeah,
and
they
Spain
were.
Was
yeah.
like, we're going to take that place.
Going to play a role here
yeah.
in a moment. We'll get there. But
right.
yeah.
So they were like, we need to get in there.
Yeah.
And she was like, Walt, go over there and establish a colony. He's like, okay. I mean, like to think that she called him Walt.
I really hope she did.
And he was like, Liz, I'm on it.
Walt and Liz. Yep.
Yeah.
They do have a very storied history, those two. So
there needs to be yeah. a Netflix show just called Walt and Liz.
Walt and Liz.
Yeah.
Well,
so.
there's a lot of shows about them.
Yeah.
But
anyway.
Yeah.
So one of the requirements of the charter was that he establish a colony by 1591 or lose it.
Yeah.
So she's like, you got a deadline.
Yeah.
It started with a military colony in 1585. And among the people in that colony was a guy named John White.
Yes. Now, John White was an artist. And so his role in this first colony, this first exploration, was as an artist. He was there to document the flora and the fauna, draw maps, do all that kind of stuff. And again, that is very important. It will play a role later on in this mystery.
Incidentally, on the tour and in the visitor center of the historic part of the park.
Yeah.
The park ranger, he had these like big cards yeah. and he was using those to help guide the discussion. And yeah. he had John White drawn, I think, flowers and
yeah.
some maps
yeah.
that John White drew. And they were actually super cool.
They were so good. Yeah.
yeah.
And there are still some of those maps that exist. And one of them's in the British Museum. And
yeah.
again, I don't want to like jump the gun here, but like it's going to play a big role into what happened to this colony later on. So
I'm going to fight to get that back to North Carolina, British Museum, please.
Well, he was British and he took it back with
care.
Him to England. So, I mean, it's
okay.
It's okay.
Yeah.
It's all right that it's there.
That map's basically Native American. So
no, it's not. Okay. So this military colony, this initial colony, they built Fort Raleigh. And they went there to build this colony, establish relationships with the native people. This, some of these groups were Tsikotans, the Croatans, and the Algonquins, right?
Yeah.
And those relationships, they were some good, they were some bad, some were good that turned bad. There's a lot of drama that happened with the native peoples and this military colony, right?
Yeah. I mean, essentially, the military colony ran out of supplies.
Yeah.
And they, like you said, were in conflict with some of the natives. The natives were sitting there like, dudes, we can live here.
Yeah.
Like, we understand like how problem? To live off the land and you guys just simply can't.
Yeah.
And they were trying to work with the natives to help them, you and know, the trade
did,
with them.
And they did help.
And they did.
They did as much as they could. And
but the settlers were basically just helpless.
Yeah. And like it, I, they told us during the tour that there was apparently like almost a gossipy moment where like yeah. one tribe is talking about another tribe and telling the colonists this and the colonists are telling it like, yeah. and there's all this hearsay and back and forth. And then all of a sudden it gets to the point where the colonists decide to attack a tribe that wasn't even planning on doing anything, you know, bad to the yeah. to the settlers. So it just like the whole thing just got out of hand and there right. was bad relations and lack of trust and whatever. So anyway, at the end of all that, they had no supplies. They didn't have help from the native groups. And by 1586, they abandoned the fort and headed back to England.
Incidentally, if you go to Fort Raleigh and you don't read the signs very closely and you take the little tour around, mm-hmm. Ranger Dan did not tell us this. And I just happened to notice this on one of the signs because we weren't really reading them either because we were taking
we were
a
listening.
Guided tour.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
I happened to notice when we were standing in front of the what looked like the remains of Fort Raleigh.
It's like a mounded grass.
Yeah, they made it look like
fort thing.
They made it look like almost excavated remains.
Yeah.
Like you would find something that was 200-300 years old, right?
Yeah.
But it's not. It's a recreation.
Right. Right.
Yeah. yeah. But they recreated it to look like the remains
yeah,
of something
like
that had been uncovered.
Yeah. Like with the grass grown over
it
and everything.
Which I appreciate from the Park Service doing that.
Yeah. I liked it.
Yeah. But
I
they
was
don't,
here for it.
But there's like a little footnote on one of the signs that said recreation. Yeah. Right. I'm like, okay. Thanks.
Yeah, I'm okay with it.
I just wish they were a little more upfront with it.
Yeah. The tour guide should have said that specifically. Yeah. And maybe it's because we were kind of engaging with him and asking questions
yeah.
and stuff. He just forgot to mention it. I'm gonna go with that.
But. I mean, we were pretty cool and he wanted to talk to us. So I get that. But.
Yeah. Anyway, so John White had headed back to England before the military sort of gave up and left. And his job when he went back was to put together a group of colonists with the aim. And this is not a military colony this time. This is yeah. actual real people, real families that just want to settle in the New World. And the aim was actually to settle in the Chesapeake Bay area. They had heard what went down with the military and they got just kind of decided that Roanoke was no longer a good choice because of all the hostilities that were caused there. So
yeah.
they're like, well, that's fine. Chesapeake looks amazing. Chesapeake is where Jamestown eventually settled, right? That's the bay just north
yeah.
of there. So anyway, the goal was to go to Chesapeake.
Well, and they had gone to get supplies too.
Yeah.
And they had intended to be back. I mean, they had to go all the way to England, but they hadn't intended to be gone all that long. I mean,
yeah.
the trip to England and back was, what, 9 months or something like that? If you just
like
could go there and get your shit and come back.
Yeah. And yeah. like it was supposed to be a resupply for the military colony. There's
right.
a lot of things that was supposed to happen. And like,
yeah,
there were other ships coming through the Roanoke area that weren't associated with John White or Sir Walter Raleigh. And like, I think the military colony hitched a ride with somebody at some point and was able to get Sir Francis Drake, I think, came through. And he's the one who ended up taking the military colony back to England. So like there was other people skipping through the area, other ships that they were able to jump on and get out of there. All right. So in 1587, John White got that group of colonists together. It was 117 people, including his pregnant daughter, which is mm-hmm. important. And they set out for what they hoped was going to be Chesapeake Bay.
So they stopped at Croatoan Island on the way to check in with the few men left behind at the military colony. But unfortunately, the ship they were on essentially forced the colonists onto land and left them there.
Yeah, I guess they just decided the ship decided they couldn't go to the Chesapeake Bay for some reason.
Yeah.
Or there was a reason why they were like, yep, this is it. Full stop. Like either
yeah.
get off here or you're going back to England. So, yeah.
So then they basically had no choice but to settle on Roanoke Island and they reused the fort that they had left behind.
Yeah. There was no reason not to reuse it. It was there
yeah.
and it wasn't like it was destroyed when they left it, so it was still standing.
Yeah, so with the help of a Croatoan man, Manteo, White and the colonists reestablished good relationships with the tribes and tried to make a go of it.
Yeah, and this is the kind of bright star of this story a little bit. So not long after they landed, the first child was born in the colonies, and her name was Virginia Dare, and she was born to White's very pregnant daughter, who was on the ship, you know, from England. So, yeah.
Yeah, so if you've ever been out to the Outer Banks, Dare County is what
a lot of the
Kildevil
Northern
Hills is in. That's where the, well, the supposed first flight of a of an airplane ever took place with the Wright brothers. It's actually Ohio, but North Carolina thinks it's here.
It's North Carolina.
Yeah.
But so, we're not rewriting that history right now. Thank you. So
anyway, Dare County is that whole thing, and that's named after Virginia Dare. And if you're watching the very terrible show Outer Banks from Netflix like we are, they call the town, or the area, Kildare.
Yeah.
Which is actually a combination, a portmanteau, if you will, of Kildare, Kildevil Hills. And Dare County.
Yeah.
So Kildare is a fictitious place.
Yes, it is.
But this is all from a baby born in 1587.
Yeah, but the first baby born in the New World.
It is,
the very
which is
first
crazy.
One. I mean, she doesn't make it for very long.
If only
think,
she'd known that she'd be part of a, you know, a Netflix show. Yeah, 400 years later.
Okay, well, so the colony settled in Roanoke, but they were kind of almost immediately in trouble.
Yeah.
They had no supplies. Relations with the native groups were shaky at best, and
because they were very needy.
Yeah, I mean, they just needed help. And I think Manteo, who was the native guy who was kind of in good with the colonists, he was trying to help them as much as he could, you know, connecting them up with the other natives. And
they
did manage to establish some relationships back to what they were before.
Yeah, they were like, Matt, we just need some supplies.
Yeah, right. But at the end of like a season there, they basically were like this place is not working. Albemarle, the island, it's too sandy. We can't grow anything here. Yeah. It's just not working. So they decided to move the colony 50 miles up the Albemarle Sound to a better location. But they really couldn't do that without more supplies and some help.
Yeah. So the colony, thinking they needed help, no better person to send than the leader of your whole entire colony, but John White. They sent him back to England to plead for supplies and help in 1587.
Yeah, and you remember the tour guide made it kind of sound like it was almost a mutiny. They were like,
right,
you got us into this.
You get us out of
it. Get your ass back to England and fix it.
Right. Yeah. So it was kind of a bad time to go, though, because as we mentioned, the Spanish and the English were not in good relations.
No.
And it just so happened the Spanish Armada was like, hey,
then.
Yeah, we're going to do this thing.
Yeah.
And the Queen Elizabeth, Liz, if you will, had just said, listen, any ship in this area, I don't care who you are or what you are, you're part of the Navy.
You're
now.
Navy now.
Yeah. And you're going to help us defeat you know, the Spanish Armada.
Yeah.
And it was essentially 3 years before White was able to sail back to Roanoke with anything.
Yeah. It's crazy, right? And there was also some bad luck with hurricanes in there, too, because we don't need to go into super detail there. But like the Outer Banks are very susceptible to hurricanes. They get hit by them all the time. And there was a ship that was sunk that had supplies that, you know, because of a hurricane.
Yeah.
There was another one that happened that stopped John White from getting back there sooner. So like just keep in the back of your mind, hurricanes are playing a big role and they are wreaking havoc on the connection between the colonists and England.
So you're very aware of, as a citizen of North Carolina, somebody who grew up here, of this lost colony and the fact that hurricanes affected their resupplies and all that stuff. And yet, literally 2 months ago, houses are falling into the sea because people built too close to the water because of hurricanes.
They just always think that they can
beat the nature.
Yeah, or they can ride, they can fix it, whatever they expect it, and they just plan to fix. Like,
there's probably,
it's so beautiful, it's worth it.
There's probably 400-year-old descendants of Native Americans living inland going, I told you so.
Like, what are you doing?
Yeah, what are you actually doing?
That's why you build houses on stilts.
Right. Well, the houses on stilts are falling into the sea.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah. If you don't know what I'm talking about, because I watch Weather Channel videos nightly, go look up houses on the Outer Banks falling into the sea. Literally this summer, like three more fell in.
Well, there was one a couple years ago. Remember, there was that one that was half washed away when we were staying at the Outer Banks. Like we were walking along the beach and it was in a place where it shouldn't have been. It was clearly a very old house that was built way too close to the ocean. And it was just like slowly washing into the sea.
There's literally $1 million houses that fell over this summer.
Yeah, it's crazy. Yeah. It's crazy. So, okay, well, back to the story.
When he got back, he looked for the colony, found no trace of the people. He went to the colony, found no trace of the people, no burials, no warfare signs.
It was just abandoned.
No anything. It was just like everybody picked up and left.
Yeah.
And the only found thing he found carved into one of the posts near the entrance of the colony was the word Croatoan.
Yeah.
Indicating, because he did say, if you're going to go, tell me where you went.
Yeah.
So he just assumed they went to Croatoan.
Well, they had a plan to meet inland up at this new location if they had to leave, but Croatoan indicates they went somewhere different, because Croatoan is an island out on in the Outer Banks. So it was confusing, I think, to him to get that message, which was directly opposite of what they had agreed before he left. But he was gone for 3 years, so, like, you know,
they gotta do what they gotta do. They didn't even know if he was coming back at that point.
Exactly.
I mean, passages across the Atlantic were rough.
They were long.
Probably when he was gone a year, they were probably like,
okay.
They're probably still holding out hope because it could take that long.
Yeah.
And they're like, yeah, but if he doesn't, we got to make do.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
So.
And so the search party, you know, they went into the palisade through the fence, and all the houses had been dismantled, which I thought was really interesting. It wasn't just that they abandoned and took all their stuff with them. They actually took apart the houses, probably for the wood or whatever they were built with, to reuse elsewhere. Mm-hmm. That's what that tells to me anyway, is that they wanted to go build somewhere else. So issues with the boat that the search party arrived on came up, and they had to return to England. So other than searching the site of their colony, there was no other real search efforts done, which always frustrated me, because I'm like, if they had just popped over to Croatoan, maybe they would have found somebody there who could tell them what had happened.
Yeah.
Or if they had gone up the Albemarle Sound a little bit, then they might have, like, found the colony there. But they didn't do any of those things. For whatever reason, something was wrong enough with the boat that they had to get out.
Yeah, but also, like, living there was really hard. And do you think they're like, I guess nobody's here. We should just go back to England where it's easy.
Maybe the other members of the search party, but John White was looking for his daughter and his granddaughter.
Yeah, but back then too, you have like lots of them.
No, right? He didn't though.
Yeah,
he died.
But you could have more.
He went back to England and died alone and sad, not ever knowing what happened to his family.
He also didn't know that was going to happen either.
Wow.
But maybe he just assumed he would remarry. I don't know.
No, I disagree with everything about that. No, the captain of the ship was probably like, all right, well, they're not here. Bye. But John White would not have done that.
Yeah.
It sounds like he was like a really good guy who was just trying to like do right by the people.
So that 15 minutes was all to just tell you to set up the story, the article we're reading right now.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, we got to talk about the theories, right?
This is a long episode, so let's just get into it.
It's fine. Okay. So the traditional theory is that because they carved the word Croatoan into the fence, that meant they joined the Croatan people and basically assimilated into that population. They carved a word into a fence. Like, why are you going to disagree with what that word says?
Right.
That's what it says. Maybe we should disagree with it. And there is further evidence of this, and it comes from later accounts in the 1600s from native Croatan people who remember family members in their tribe that had lighter colored eyes, lighter hair, and just had a more European appearance. And I think that some of these genetic characteristics carried into the population later on, too.
Yeah. Was this the one, too, where people remembered that some people in that area could, like, read from a book or something
like
that?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And so these are, like, coming from sources from the 1600s of people just talking about it. So,
which wouldn't have been too uncommon necessarily. It doesn't mean it was these colonists or settlers. It could have been somebody else.
I mean, there were people coming over.
There were Spanish. There were other English people. It didn't have to be these settlers.
Yeah, exactly. So
these were barrier islands.
It's nice circumstantial evidence, but it's not like real true evidence.
Yeah, it doesn't mean it was those guys.
Okay, so here's the new theory. And this is what is supposedly like solving the mystery of Roanoke, this new theory, right? And it comes from the British Museum, and there's a map there, we talked about this earlier, that White had painted of Elizabethan era United States.
Yeah.
And hidden in invisible ink, presumably to guard whatever was on the map from the Spanish who might have captured the map.
This is the plot of National Treasure 3.
I know, right? So there's the outlines of two forts. One was 50 miles west of Roanoke, where there was no fort that we knew of, right? But it was on that map in invisible ink. And this is the same distance away that the colonists had told White they planned to move. So he plotted on the map where they were planning on moving the colony.
Yeah. A group from the First Colony Foundation, which is you know, a bunch of people interested in this, explored the location indicated on the map. And at two different sites, they found ceramic sherds from English pottery that dates to the time period of the colony.
Yeah. Right? And it's like, otherwise, why would those sherds be there, right? Why would those ceramics be there?
Now, this pottery type also overlaps with the Jamestown colony that would have been just north of there. And they can't rule them out as the source of the pottery, right? Because Jamestown was... not that much later.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it, what was so, it, 20 years later or something like that?
Yeah, like 20, 30 years. In,
which isn't that
in
much
ceramic,
time.
Yeah, in ceramic typology, that's not very much time. And also, I believe our tour guide told us that the military colony was sending expeditions out all over North Carolina. So I was also like, well, couldn't those shirts just be from a military expedition that set out and, you know, dropped a bunch of stuff?
One of my favorite arguments about this not being Jamestown is that the lack of English pipes, because apparently the Jamestown people are like heavy smokers.
I know. I kind of find that a dumb, that's dumb, that reasoning, but like.
But it also does make sense because maybe Jamestown was better supplied and they just didn't have any tobacco at the Roanoke colonies, colonists.
They did not.
Yeah.
Well, they weren't. I mean,
they could have been heavy smokers like a lot of English people probably were.
Yeah.
But they just ran out of tobacco.
But the absence of an artifact does not prove that it's not somebody. But in, you
this
know?
Case, but in this case, it might, because, you know, those for those people that have never excavated this kind of thing before, your pipes, you have the actual pipe, which is a really nice, usually,
it's like the kaolin. Is it that those kinds, those white ones?
Well, hold on though. So, because you've got the actual, could have been ivory or bone, the actual pipe, right? Or it could be ceramic, right? Yeah. But then the pipe stem is the thing that wears out.
Yeah.
Right. That it builds up with tar and you can clean it out, but that's a piece that's usually, replaced.
Yeah.
Right. Now, they could have found actual pipes, obviously, because they would people die and stuff like that. But the pipe stems is what you find all over the place.
Right. Because they get discarded.
If they found none of those.
Yeah. It means that nobody was smoking there.
Right. So.
So I guess it's okay. It's circumstantial. Again, more circumstantial evidence.
But it's not terrible.
But I mean, I do love that theory though. Like, they had a map drawn by John Smith of where they were supposed to be. So like, it does feel pretty good. The one detractor, one guy who was like, not really into this theory, was saying that these guys at the First Colony Foundation, they are seeking to prove a theory rather than disprove a theory.
Oh, Charles Ewan. I've met him before. I've talked to him.
Oh, really? Okay. Yeah. So yeah, he said that, and it's like you that's not science. That's not how you do science. You disprove things, you don't prove them.
He used to be president of the Society of Historical Archaeology.
Okay. Yeah, so I do kind of understand that too. I do understand that, but like, if you have a historical source from the time period pointing you in a certain direction, you do kind of have to go check that out and see what you find.
You do.
And they found things.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to need to find graves.
Right.
And I don't know if they're going to find graves, but that's what they need to do, is find graves or a town site or something to really prove that this is it.
And if they don't find graves, actually, that kind of is somewhat proving the third theory, is that they were killed or captured by native groups, because they're not going to bury them. They're going to leave them scattered, and then and then they're going to get eaten by animals.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. So. And there would have been native groups that were still hostile towards colonists, you know, because of issues with the military colony, things like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But then again, why was the fort neatly abandoned with everything of value taken with them and not just looted or destroyed? But that's probably because they did abandon the fort, but then maybe wherever they were headed to, you know, they wandered into native territory or something like that. And then we're probably, you know, the natives were like, look at all that stuff they've got. These guys are a bunch of idiots. They're just wandering around. They're probably hungry and starving. And my guess is they probably left the fort with no food, no anything.
Yeah.
And maybe even they probably tried to get something from a native group. We're under-equipped to do that.
It might have gone bad. Yeah. Well, okay. So the fourth theory that, again, it's just so unlikely, is that they tried to sail away and died.
I don't think that's too unlikely.
Well, I mean, yeah, because they had small boats. They didn't have ocean seafaring boats. They had little pop around the sound kind of boats, because they took the big ones back to England.
And they didn't have the Weather Channel app. Stuff pops up real quick.
Right?
Yeah.
So it seems if they did try that, then they certainly would have died at sea. But it does seem a little bit unlikely that they would. Yeah. Why would they have dismantled their houses to go rebuild elsewhere, but then also sail away into the sea? So I don't know about that.
And I think the sort of fifth theory that was mentioned in at least one of these articles was that they split up.
Yeah.
Some of them went to Croatoan and some of them went inland.
Yeah.
And we'll just really never know the truth.
Yeah.
Right? Because there is pretty credible evidence on Croatoan that
there
were quote unquote white people there.
Yeah.
Right. And if there was a very small number of people that actually made it there.
Yeah.
The archaeological evidence would be scant.
And,
right.
And their buddy Manteo was Croatan. Yeah. So he was.
He could have gotten there.
He was clearly willing to smooth the path
right.
for the colonists in with the natives. So yeah. like that does seem like a really likely theory. But this new theory is really good too.
There is a sixth theory. They were all abducted by aliens.
Oh my God.
And they're currently living their lives out.
Why do you have to bring aliens into every episode?
But it didn't have to be aliens. It could have been the Starship Enterprise. And they were like, these guys were abandoned by history, like anyway. So let's just take them and start up a new civilization on another planet in the 21st
century. What is the first rule of Star Trek?
The Prime Directive.
Uh-huh.
But they knew that these guys were the lost colony already to history. So uh-huh. they just took them anyway since they were already dead.
Oh, I see.
Nobody knows where they're at.
That still breaks the Prime Directive.
No, that is the historic... It's humans. There is no Prime Directive. Right? So they took them anyway and took them to another place because, you know, why not?
You're done.
Yeah. That's what I would do if I were a time traveler. I would go to things I already know were historically, you know, out of the picture and just remove them from the gene pool.
Oh, if you're bringing time travel into it, sure.
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
Well, obviously the Enterprise came back in time.
Oh, I didn't know the Enterprise was time traveling.
They don't exist in this century, so obviously.
Right, of course.
Yeah. So,
okay, anyway, well, anyway, that was
clearly the answer.
Ridiculous.
I mentioned to the park ranger aliens right at the end, and he was like, hey, I'm not going to say no. To his credit.
I hate aliens. I hate all alien theories. I can't handle them.
See, that's the
they're
thing
too
about,
ridiculous.
I mean, I like to make fun of it, but, you know, as a scientist, in an infinite universe, aliens exist.
Oh, I hate infinite universe theories more than I hate aliens.
But actually, the universe is infinite.
I actually hate that more. Great.
The universe is definitely infinite, and other species exist.
I hate it so
Whether or not they're...
Can we just live in the real world that we're in currently?
Whether or not those species... are sentient and can actually travel the universe is another question, but the universe mm-hmm. is so big, the likelihood of them actually ever coming here is so remote.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, and the likelihood of them existing at the same time as us is actually remote as well. There could have been whole civilizations that could travel the universe that lived a billion years ago, and now they're dead. We just didn't sync up.
Okay, you done?
Okay, I'm done now. All right, see you
so we're moving on from theory.
Okay.
And just a little quick recap here, because we kind of got off the rails there. We don't actually know what happened to the Roanoke colony still, but there is this new theory that is an interesting one, and it is challenging the status quo of what we thought could have happened before. So
right.
I think we managed to solve zero mysteries in this podcast today.
Hello.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine.
Well, yeah. All I know is the map that John White drew would probably tune on cup real nicely.
Oh, Jesus.
See you next week.
Bye.
Thanks for listening to The Archaeology Show. Feel free to comment and view the show notes on the website at www.arcpodnet.com. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at arcpodnet. Music for this show is called I Wish You Would Look from the band Sea Hero. Again, thanks for listening and have an awesome day. This episode was produced by Chris Webster from his RV traveling the United States, Tristan Boyle in Scotland, DigTech LLC, Cultural Media, and the Archaeology Podcast Network, and was edited by Chris Webster.
This has been a presentation of the Archaeology Podcast Network. Visit us on the web for show notes and other podcasts at www.archpodnet.com. Contact us at chris@archaeologypodcastnetwork.com.